The Lisa Show is happening now.
It's happening now.
With Lisa Valentine Clark and Richie T. It's the Lisa Show.
Are you worried that you have too much personal information on the internet? Well, coming up in about 20 minutes, we're going to share some secret tips on how you can be able to take it off. And breaking tragic news out of Florida. That's coming up in your morning buzz. Our own brains like to play tricks on us. You're looking for that bottle of milk in the fridge, and you look behind all the other products and corners and even that drawer. You know that drawer. You're thinking maybe it made its way into that drawer, and you realize it's just staring right back at you, front and center. You know that feeling of looking for something that's right in front of us, but that's not the only trick that our brain knows. In fact, many times we do just the opposite, and we believe that we see things that aren't even there. So why is it that our brain plays these different games with us instead of just helping us find and understand the truth? Well, today we're talking with Susan Nolan about why this happens and how we might be able to prevent it. Susan is a professor at the Department of Psychology at Seton Hall and is the president of the Society for Teaching of Psychology. Welcome, Susan.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So we've all done this. Sweetheart, have you seen that? And then the other person comes to the fridge and says, it's clearly right there. Is it obvious? Is it a thing that brains have given us so that we need that other person in our life to be able to help us? Why does this occur?
It's something that is often called inattentional blindness. So it's almost that we cannot see it because we're not paying attention. Our brains can only take so much in. And sometimes we're just walking around the world and we miss something crazy obvious.
And I think that exists, like when we're looking, for something, maybe in the fridge or around our home. But I don't think that these same kind of things, and maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think we miss like the car in the intersection or these sort of heightened situations where it's our safety that's at play. It seems to be these more mundane activities.
We actually do, and that's what's kind of crazy. The classic experiment is called the invisible gorilla. And actually, if your listeners Google invisible gorilla video, they can try it for themselves. You're watching basketball players, some wearing white, some wearing black, and you're told to count how many times the white team passes the ball. And you're watching and you're paying attention. You're pretty good at it. And when it's over, you think, okay, it's whatever number. And then you're told that you missed a gorilla walking through the game. And sure enough, play it again. There's a gorilla. And there are different versions. There's one with a moonwalking bear. And people miss it. The United Kingdom actually used one of these as a public service announcement because drivers were missing cyclists. And so cyclists were getting hit by cars because drivers weren't looking for them and they just didn't see them. So it does occur in very dangerous real world contexts, too.
So are there, because we know this, then are there people that have taken advantage of this? I'm not sure the application where one could take advantage of it, but has there been manipulation on that side?
Oh, sure. If you've ever been to a city where you've got the guy with the shells moving them around and you place a bet as to, and they use sleight of hand. Magicians use this all the time. They distract you in one way so that you're not seeing what they're really doing. The very real world implication for all of us, though, because every single one of us maneuvers around the world, whether we're walking or driving, the real world implication is that we're using our smartphone. And when we're doing that, and there's overwhelming evidence in experiments where they have control groups and everything, that we are distracted even by talking on the phone, never mind texting or browsing. The one thing that seems to be pretty safe is listening to music. So if you're walking around or driving your car, listen to music, but disconnect from talking to people.
And you said that it's an overabundance of information. So is there a way that we can filter things down? I mean, you mentioned just music and not being able to have these other distractions. But just in life, going back to the fridge example, I can be very undistracted and still go to the fridge, but it's that overwhelm of information. Is there, I don't know that a cure, that might be that might be too extreme, but is there a prevention of some of this?
So there are a couple of tricks. And one is keeping things in the same place. There's this idea of cognitive load, that we have so many things going on in our brains, if we can remove some of that. So here's one small example. When I drive to my campus, or hopefully will soon when the pandemic's over, I park my car in the same place in the garage every day. It's a little further away because there will be a space there. And then I don't have to think when I go back to the garage, where's my car? The more we can do that, hanging the key on a magnet board, putting your shoes away right when you come home, the more you can do that, keeping the milk in the same spot in the fridge all the time so you don't have to look for it. The other thing is, we talk about, people will say, I'm good at multitasking.
Right.
Well, nobody's good at multitasking.
No.
Again, tons of research. And in fact, you should call it task switching, because you're not doing two things at once. If you're doing two things at once, you're switching between them and you're not doing as well at either. So one thing at a time.
Now, when I hear you talking about like the parking and the keeping things in the same place and stuff like that, I'm reminded of like stories that we hear of some of today's most innovative thinkers, right? Where they have the same outfit that they wear every day, right? Like a uniform, so they don't have to mm-hmm. think about it. Is this part of that, or is that something sort of just similarly related?
Well, that's, I think, a little extreme, wearing the same thing every day. But I know a lot of people do a version of that where they have outfits together in the closet. So you get up in the morning, you don't have to pick the pants and the shirt. It's like, oh, there's an outfit. There are ways you can do that and getting rid of stuff, getting rid of things that you don't use routinely. There are lots of tricks for that. Clothes that you don't wear, you know, hang them backwards. And then if you wear them, turn the hanger around. And at the end of 6 months, anything that hasn't been worn, get rid of it. Same thing in your kitchen. Take out all the stuff out of your kitchen cabinets and kind of stack it. And then as you use things, put them away. And at the end of a couple months, if there's something you're not using, get rid of it. That reduces cognitive load too.
If you're just joining the conversation, we're talking with Susan Nolan about our brain and the lovely tricks that it plays on us. And we've been sort of talking about not being able to see things, not being able to find things, this cognitive overload. But does the reverse work? Do we also see things that actually, in fact, aren't there? Is that a trick our brain likes to throw in there?
Oh, absolutely. There's a great study that Matthew Sharps and colleagues did where they took a picture of a moon, just a regular moon in the sky, and they blanked it out, the moon part. So it was just a white disk in the sky. And they told half of their participants, what you're looking at is something in our solar system. And the other half, they said, you're looking at something out there in the universe, and authorities have said that there are structures on it. And about a third of the people who thought it was out there in the universe and authorities had seen structures on it reported seeing structures and colors. And these were just, you know, university students. These were not people who were invested in seeing it there. It's remarkable what we do with that. And the classic examples there are Bigfoot and the Loch Ness Monster and mm-hmm. all of those kind of what they call cryptids.
Now, Susan, you say that Bigfoot is not real. And I don't want to, you know, take you to task, but I'm firmly believe. No, I'm just teasing.
Well, and you know, these things might be real. Let's say possibly. Mm-hmm. What I'll say is there's no compelling evidence that it's real.
Now, what about this in relationships or within our culture? Does it go beyond like items and objects? Do we start to see things like biases or like you know, cultural shifts that may not be there, or we don't see them and they in fact are there?
Absolutely. Psychologists call this confirmation bias. We walk around the world looking for things that confirm what we already believe, what we already think, and we ignore, and we're not doing this intentionally, but we're not paying attention when there's something that doesn't fit with that. So you mentioned relationships earlier. If I am in a good relationship and my husband forgets my birthday, I think, oh, wow, he must have a lot going on. And I look for the good in that. If right. I'm in a bad relationship and he forgets my birthday, I think, oh, he's a terrible person. So we fit whatever happens into our narrative, even if it's the same exact thing.
So in that particular scenario, not necessarily the husband and the birthday, but with those things that we identify as a confirmation bias, how do we then expand it out and not have that occur, similar to the, you know, unloading the cognitive overload of things being in different places in our fridge? How do we do that with our confirmation biases?
So great question. And a really important thing for us to do is to listen to people who have different ideas from ourselves. So, for example, I love to listen to podcasts. I make a point to listen to podcasts with different viewpoints, including ones that I know I'm not going to agree with. Because it allows me to think about different ideas and maybe, and I'm sure I still have confirmation bias. I'm a human. We all do. But it helps me a lot to do that. And I really encourage people. We sometimes are in our own bubbles and all we hear are people who think like us. Mm-hmm. And the more we can listen to other viewpoints, even if it's on a podcast, even better in real life, have right. the conversations, have the debates. But even if it's just on a podcast, make your brain take in information that's different from what you believe.
I want to drill down on that a little bit more, because I think that's something that as a society, if I can blanket statement something, that's something that we're not good at. Particularly the engagement with actual people and being able to have civil discourse, certainly, but even just to go out on a limb and listen to something that we wouldn't actually listen to, because just the listening to it, if we're not actively listening, if we're not open to being able to listen to it, you know, we're not going to get anywhere with it. How do you engage that, or what sort of tips would you have for someone who's like, yeah, I probably should. They listen for 5 minutes and just get so angry because this doesn't confirm everything that they thought, to make it a beneficial experience?
Well, one thing is, so I teach, I'm a professor, and in my classrooms, psychology research doesn't, no matter where you fall on the political spectrum, United States, there's psychology research that's going to not fit with your beliefs. So there are findings that would bolster more conservative arguments. There are findings that would bolster more liberal arguments. So I tell my students, I'm going to share with you the research, and some of it's going to challenge you no matter where you are. Mm-hmm. And so you have to sit with that. So, you know, again, kind of forcing yourself to sit with that and to not give up after 5 minutes. I think it's a choice we have to make. It's hard. You are absolutely right. It's hard for all of us.
And unfortunately, it's a choice that not as many of us make as probably should. And so at that point, we can't be making choices for other people. Right. And no matter how loud I talk, some people just won't listen, Susan.
That's crazy.
Are there other tricks that our brain plays on us, either things that aren't there and actually do exist, or vice versa, or any other, I guess, just brain tricks that we haven't discussed?
Oh, yo, tons and tons of them. One of my favorites is something called the availability heuristic. And heuristic's just another word for tool or trick. Mm-hmm. But we overestimate things that are salient to us that we can think of easily. So we're afraid of sharks, mm-hmm. because it's easy to call up to mind a shark attack, because that makes the international news. But we're not afraid of the most common animal to kill people in the United States, which is deer. We hit deer with our cars. We drive around and we see a deer by the side of the road and we say, oh, look at that nice deer. But we should be more scared of them than we are of sharks. So the availability heuristic is one of my favorites. Plane crashes too. We're afraid of planes crashing. Mm-hmm. It's very rare, but they make the international news. Car crashes are far, 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 far more common.
Well, now I'm afraid of car and deer, Susan.
You should be defensive around them. Oh, absolutely.
I appreciate that change of phrase. I should be defensive around them. What else? I love that you said you have a favorite sort of brain trick. Are there others worth noting?
Sure. Another heuristic is the representativeness heuristic. And that's when we sort of peg somebody. So the classic example is, Mary is very interested in books and writing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Do you think it's more likely that she's an accountant or a well-known fiction writer? And people will say, well, well-known fiction writer. But in fact, there are very few well-known fiction writers, and there's tons of accountants. So we tend to peg people, even if it doesn't really make sense based on the percentage in society. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And you're right. And even further kind of on that heuristic part of it, like that we're so sure, oh, of course that person would be this profession based on these things. And you're right. We don't think of it in a broader perspective.
Absolutely.
It's fascinating to me to know that my brain is playing so many tricks on me.
Well, and that's the thing. I mean, I think if we can all sort of admit, I mean, one of the things that happened to me a few years back, I love to jog. I hate to stretch. Uh-huh. I saw an article in the news that said it's, you know, not helpful to stretch. And I just, all right, fine. I don't stretch anymore.
Yeah.
So you cherry pick, but what if I dug in more? I kind of don't want to know. I don't want to hear the information that's going to make me do something I don't want to do. We all do this. If we can admit it to ourselves, maybe we can all get a little better at it. And maybe that'll help bring us together. I mean, we mentioned politics earlier. If we can all try a little harder, and we'll all fail a lot, but it's work and we need to do it.
As we sort of wrap out this conversation, are there other dangers aside from deer and car accidents that with our brain and whether it be socially or culturally, as a community or even just within our own homes, that are those tricks that our brain plays on us that we should really be aware of and try and work and find our way through? Are you still there, Susan? Oh, it sounds like we lost Susan. All right. Well, Susan Nolan, a professor in the Department of Psychology at Seton Hall University, also the 2021 president of the Society for the Teaching of Psychology. If you want to find out more about Susan Nolan, you can follow her on Twitter at Susan_A_Nolan. Now, coming up in your morning buzz, a real tragedy. The pictures of this are trending online right now, coming out of Florida. We'll get back right with that. You're listening to The Lisa Show. If you've been wondering, how is NASCAR helping the American Brain Tumor Association? Well, answers to your questions coming up in 20 minutes. We're going to be joined by Matt Tift, a former NASCAR driver, to find out what exactly NASCAR's doing with the American Brain Tumor Association. But first, I have for you your morning buzz. Three stories that are trending online today, things that people are talking about. And this first one, had an interesting conversation just about this morning. You think of your security on your computer and you think, oh yeah, but it's the McAfee, right? Everyone has the McAfee security, but no one has ever really thought about who or what McAfee is named after. Well, American software pioneer John McAfee is who it's named after. He, at the age of 75, was found dead in a prison cell in Barcelona. Just hours earlier, a court in Spain had approved the extradition of McAfee to the United States, where he was set to stand trial on federal tax evasion charges. Authorities are still investigating the cause of his death. If you're experiencing a heat wave where you're at today, a holiday for you, swim a lap day. Now, I would recommend it that you put your bathing suit on first, but it is not mandatory. You can if you're just like, oh, so hot. So hot. I heard 117 for 3 days straight down in Phoenix. I heard it's going to be over 100 in places like Seattle today. So if it's just hot, even if you don't have your bathing suit, swim a lap day. That's how you can celebrate swim a lap day. And you know what? I'll even extend it this much further. You can't do the whole lap, swim half a lap day. And then finally, this story, this one coming out of Florida, and the pictures of this are trending online, and just a horrible tragedy out of Surfside, Florida. At least one person was killed, and a massive search and rescue effort is underway currently following the partial collapse of a 12-story condo building. The Miami-Dade Fire Rescue officials said more than 100 units have responded to the beachfront condo just after 2 a.m. this morning. The collapse sent a cloud of debris through the neighborhood, coating cars up to two blocks away with a light layer of dust. Footage from the scene showed a large section of the sea view side of the building collapsed into a pile of rubble. And if you remember from about 20 years or so ago, the Oklahoma City bombing and how it looks like just that side of that building is just sheared and fallen. That's what it looks like in this 12-story condo building. They aren't suspecting anything like an Oklahoma City. They think it's faulty within the building. They haven't been able to obviously, as they're still trying to search and rescue folks out of the building, be able to find a cause. But people in the neighborhood are reflecting that they heard a series of booms, and that might just be the falling of the building. But that is certainly something that that people are talking about today, and the thoughts and prayers of all encouraged to be sent down to Surfside, Florida, as they deal with this horrible tragedy. And that is your morning buzz. Most people know the saying that once something is on the internet, it never leaves. But is that really true? If you have social media or accounts set up on different websites or even just a computer, it's most likely that your information is out there. So what's being done with that data? Who can see it? And is it ever possible to really get something off of the internet? Whether it's an embarrassing video or something maybe more serious, we want to find out if, in fact, it is possible to remove it from the internet. So to help us, we've invited Haley Kaplan, an internet privacy expert, to share some advice. Welcome, Haley.
Thank you.
So first of all, it's great to have you back on the show. Enjoyed our conversation with you so much before. We thought, man, this internet thing is much bigger than just one 15-minute segment. Let's get Haley back and be able to talk about, is it possible to actually remove something from the internet if it has been put out there?
Yes, but no at the same time. So it's very, very dependent on what kind of information it is. For the most part, in actuality, everything is removable because somebody put it there, right? So if you reach that person, you can remove it, and you can remove it from as many places as it's gotten to. But in actuality, and the reality of things, is people aren't often willing to do that. So bottom line is you want to be real careful with what you do and what you post. Because some of it is up there because of stuff you did, and some of it is there without your knowledge and without your control.
Yeah, I, as a parent, just anecdotally, I would always say, hey, before you're thinking about posting something online, think if in 20 years you're still going to want to be there. And my son would kind of look at me sort of blank face, and I'd be like, and then I want you to think if I might be upset that it's still there in 20 years, and hopefully creating those kind of couple of stops that we go, is this something that we really want to have be out there? And that's if we're posting something that we ourselves are controlling. So often, as you indicate, it might be something that somebody else is sharing about us.
Yes, and you know, sometimes intentionally somebody's sharing it for malicious reasons or sometimes innocent reasons, but then there's other stuff that generates from public records, from newspaper articles, and that is the kind of stuff that people like your kid have absolutely no control over, except to behave well in the first place and not do stuff that would cause it to get on there in the first place.
Yeah. When probably most popular, I think about friends, whether they're in real life or just social media friends who have said, you know what, I'm leaving this platform, whatever that social media platform may be. I'm disabling my account. I'm done. I'm gone. Is their information actually gone or is that stored somewhere?
Oh, it's definitely stored there, and I don't recommend that at all.
You don't recommend removing yourself?
I don't recommend removing yourself from a social media platform because if you're not on that platform, you can't see what other people are saying about you. At least if you're on there, you don't have to post and you can control what you're putting on there, but you can still be a voyeur.
What would be the value in that? Just knowing that if someone is saying something negative or malicious, you can be able to contact it at the source?
Yeah, or unintentional as well. Do you have time for a quick story?
Of course.
I'm on Facebook, and I see a friend of mine who's very influential in the community. Oh, my God. She's at a party, and clearly someone's given it to her. There's people all around her. This is really inappropriate. Imagine what her kids are going to think. Imagine what other people in the community are going to think. So I discreetly call her up. And I tell her, you know, I came across this picture. And she said to me, well, I know, but somebody else posted it, and so I have no control. And I said, absolutely you do. The person that posted it thinks it's funny. It's not funny at all that it's there. You need to contact her and ask her to take it down. And so she did, and the woman did take it down. So that's an example where somebody posted it. If she wasn't on social media, well, I would have found it in that particular case since I went to her. But what happens if I hadn't and no one else was comfortable letting her know that it was there? Then it would have been there forever and would have looked pretty bad. You can imagine, you know, a picture like that in the wrong eyes, how that would come across.
Absolutely. You know, I think about these experiences, and I've seen this in our local community where there are businesses that have posted pictures on their you know, their business social media page. And this was fairly early on. I feel like we've sort of self-corrected and people have known better than this. But
in the early times of the pandemic were sharing pictures. I'm thinking of one that particular was a wedding venue where no one was masked. There were, you know, too many people for the city and local restrictions under the pandemic, and nobody was masked. And I remember the blowback and just bad press that this particular venue got because they had shared a picture that just said that they were disregarding what was going on. And they, of course, deleted it, but several people had screenshotted it before they got the chance to remove it.
Right. And that is one of the things about removing. So once something is removed, if it's removed properly, number one, it gets removed from the site. Number two, it has to be removed from Google, because what a lot of people don't realize is that result can still remain in Google, and there's a teeny little down arrow next to the top line of the Google result. Mm-hmm. And if you click on that down arrow, the word cached pops up, and then you can click on the word cached, and then you can see what was there before it was deleted.
Mm.
So removals are a couple of steps. You've got a number one from the site, number two from search engines as well.
Now, if we want to find out about ourselves, the kind of presence, the stamp that we have on the internet or in the digital space, what maybe aside from Googling, or is Googling the best way to find that out?
There's so many different ways that your information is captured that Googling is definitely the first best step, but it's not the final step. So there's a lot of different ways to Google yourself. You don't just want to put in your name. And depending on the person's name, it's going to be very different because some people have common names.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so a lot of other stuff is going to come up. So you want to start to give Google a little bit more information about yourself as you're doing the search to make sure that you're seeing everything that pertains to you without having to go through all this other stuff. There are specific search terms. There's advanced searches. You can go to Google how to do advanced searches, and that will show you how to exclude certain bits of information, include more. One of the things that I like to do, because one of the services that I offer that's important to people for removing personal information that's not only on Google but on a bunch of different data broker sites. So this isn't the reputation stuff. This is just name, age, family members' address, criminal records, licenses you may own, all sorts of just stuff that comes in from public records, from official public records, and is picked up by those sites. So one of the tricks that I use is to put your name and your address. And that will pick up a lot of the Google results that include your name and address together.
Hmm.
But there's over 300 sites out there that gather that kind of information, and they're not all optimized to come into Google.
Hmm.
So there's some very common sites that are very invasive, very popular sites. And so you want to go directly to some of those sites to find that information and to remove it as well. And we've been talking a lot about social media, but there's so many types of information that come up online that are not social media as well.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to restrict yourself to social media because you could be missing out the most important stuff. For example, in my work, I'll have people coming to me with all sorts of problematic posts for them. Maybe they got into a dispute with a customer. Maybe they got into a dispute personally with someone. Maybe there was a sexual harassment situation. And people will create websites just to badmouth and ruin somebody's reputation.
Wow.
So you've really got to be looking for more than official sites.
Mm.
And so the first step of knowing what to do is to be diligent about always looking yourself up on Google. They've got, right now there's all these things on the media about them being a monopoly, but the truth is I find that to be a very handy search engine. It does track everything you're doing. So I also use another one called Epic. But since Google is so popular and so common, it's really important to see what's on there, because what's on Google may not be exactly the same as what's on some of the other search engines. They don't all pick up the identical thing.
Yeah, just using it as another source. We're talking, if you're just listening to us, we're talking with Haley Kaplan, who is an internet privacy expert. You mentioned that you, a lot of this that we've been discussing, you will actually do for clients, people who come to you and say, hey, help me, you know, remove this information from the internet. Do you find that most people come to you in cases of, you know, oh, I did this silly thing when I was younger and I want that to disappear? Or is it more they want to be kind of anonymous and not have big data have their information? Who are those that use and patronize your services the most?
That's hard to say, because almost every single person that comes to me comes with a different situation and a different set of needs. Mm. So, for example, if somebody's been raped or a victim of stalking, what's most important to them is that they can't be found in terms of their home address.
Yeah.
So there's not reputational issues at stake here. It's just really safety. So it's really important that I am very, very thorough about removing anything that would lead to where they are physically located. Then there are people that you mentioned, someone that may have had a misstep, maybe a kid in school had a DUI, and this is following them 20 years later mm-hmm. on the internet, and they don't want to be punished forever. I'm about to do a consult with somebody who has a bankruptcy, and that's hurting her. There was someone who had bikini photos online, and she actually told me that she had done a photo shoot when she was underage, and now that she was working for a company, it wasn't professional to have bikini photos up there. The company had gone out of business too since then. But when I started to do my homework and my research, it turned out that she really was 18, and she'd entered a bikini contest for a prize and won. Congratulations to her.
Yeah.
And so it really was her actions that caused it to be up there. But when you're 18, you're not thinking, when I'm 28 and these bikini pictures are showing up and I'm in a professional position, that really is awkward. So people have to start to really think about what they're doing and what the consequences are, because they're ending up online. Number one, inadvertently by mistake, people find it out. And number two, when people are unhappy, they're really taking to the online world to let it be known, and they're harming people in terrible, terrible ways.
There is so much that I would imagine, too, that has grown within this space that we're just sort of constantly learning, and things that we would have maybe never considered at the advent of the internet, that now we're saying, oh, this is being tracked, this is being followed, people can find this information. Where for people that are concerned about this, maybe they want to take some things in their own hands, or maybe even hire you. What is a great resource to be able to start to either take back their information or really get an idea of internet safety?
Well, on my website, I have a couple websites. My main website is what-is-privacy.com. And in the upper right-hand corner of that site, I have a blog. And I have dedicated many, many, many hundreds of hours to writing articles to help people about being safe online. So there's that sort of informational guidance on very specific areas. And you can click on one of the subjects that's remove online information, and then you'll find articles related to that. I offer a lot of free tutorials on how to remove yourself from data broker sites. I don't put in a lot of information about removing other types of information because, as I said from the start, it's so diverse.
Yeah.
What happened? I had a client that came to me where one of his clients was very upset, and he put a very pornographic photograph online that was showing up. He is an attorney, and he had a very taboo type of photograph with naked people in the background and him doing something indiscreet. The good thing was, because there was some pornography involved, there are laws associated, well, not laws, but Google, for example, will remove revenge porn if something is breaking copyright. Now, they'll remove it from the search engine, which is great, because they're not saying you have to get it off of the site first, but then there's so many search engines, so you really do want to go to the source.
Yeah.
But when people are using Google a lot, and suddenly, you know, with these law firms, there's this naked picture. It's a huge problem.
Right.
So it's nice that Google has a mechanism, because it fits into the category of revenge porn, to remove it right away.
Yeah.
But then you have to use other means to get to the source, which it was coming from a website that this particular person created, specifically to shame this lawyer because he was mad that he wouldn't keep him as a client.
Hmm. Wow. Wow. And that and these types of things in different ways constantly occurring, people finding new ways to be able to do this. A conversation that I don't know that we'll ever get to the bottom of everything, but that I've really enjoyed being able to talk about how we can remove some information from the internet, and giving your website, which is what-is-privacy.com, as a resource is a tremendous benefit to those that have been listening to this conversation. We've been visiting with
another site. I'm so sorry to interrupt you, but I just launched a brand new site called removeonlineinfo.com.
And another great place that people can be able to find out similar, I would imagine?
Yes, I just, because it's new, I don't have a lot of articles associated with it yet, but I intend to put articles specifically related to that over time, at least one a month.
Awesome.
So that will hopefully be a resource. And I've got a contact form if people have questions, because, again, we've not even come close to skimming the surface of the subject matter.
Mm-hmm.
There is one of the questions that I didn't quite get to, is everything removable? And I said yes and no. So going back to that, some stuff that can't be removed, there's still things that you can do to lessen the reputation damage. And that's not a service I do myself, but it's still important to know about it, where you build other positive content to push the result down.
Mm.
But first step is always, on anything that's problematic, to try to remove it,
mm-hmm.
because even though it's very daunting and you may think it's never going to be done, just like the person with that photograph, it was, and she was so relieved, and it wasn't that hard to remove in that particular case. And if other people had captured screenshots, they weren't sharing them.
Right.
So that was a good thing.
Yeah.
So.
You are a tremendous resource. We hope that we can have you again on the show. Haley Kaplan, internet privacy expert. And we will leave the show note in the show notes, those websites that you shared with us. Thank you so much for being on the show with us. A website you'll also see in the show notes, byuradio.org. Go there and enter for Lisa's Adventure Club, giving away another annual National Parks Pass tomorrow on the show. You can't win if you don't enter, byuradio.org. Lots of ways to get for you to get more entries, the most of which is the keyword of the week, the password, the secret word, whatever you want to call it. The word is snacks. And it makes me hungry because I don't have any snacks in here today. Snacks, S-N-A-C-K-S. Enter that in when you're prompted. You'll get more entries to try and win an annual National Parks Pass. Do it right now, byuradio.org. Coming up, we're going to share an inspiring story about one NASCAR driver who found his way after learning that he couldn't race again. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Sometimes we race towards our dreams. Sometimes those dreams come to a screeching halt. And sometimes we have to decide to change direction at a moment's notice. I think that's probably a sentiment that every one of us from the last 18 months can probably, you know, say I've experienced at least that on some level. But probably not this level. Today, we're going to be hearing from someone who has made that pivotal choice to change directions and then keep going. Matt Tift is a former NASCAR driver who turned to be a NASCAR owner due to some life-changing health discoveries, and he's here to tell us about his journey and how he's working to help those who need it the most. Welcome, Matt.
Well, thanks for having me on. How are you doing?
I'm doing very well. If you'll forgive the racing pun, I ask that you take us, let us sit down in the passenger seat and take us back a little bit in your journey.
Sure. Yes. So I'm currently 25 years old, so still at the ripe old age, I guess, of 25.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, but gosh, it feels like it's been dragging on for a bit here. But you know, it really starts back when I was a kid. I grew up going to the racetrack. I grew up just south of Cleveland, Ohio. And my dad, he was a big race fan growing up. And so when I was little, his high school buddy, he went to high school in Michigan. So my grandparents lived there. And so we, in the summers, we'd go over there and watch racing. And so, you know, from 5, 6 years old, I got the bug, as they call it, just the sights and the sounds and the smells of the race car and the fuel and the loud engines and everything like that. So I was hooked. So when I was about 11 years old, I finally convinced my parents to go do a local tryout of a go-kart at a track near us in Ohio, at the Barberton Speedway. So I started in go-kart racing, and these aren't, you know, not amusement park go-karts. They're 70, 80 mile an hour go-karts, sitting about an inch off the ground. And by the time I was 12 years old, I was already training in stock cars, or the type that you kind of see that are a little bit smaller size. NASCARs. So
yeah, it's worth noting. Sorry to interrupt real quick, but it's worth noting. So at 12, 4 years before you could actually drive a car on a road, you have moved into these super fast cars. Go ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. No, when I was 13 years old, I was full-fledged racing these cars that were, they go about 150 miles an hour. We actually raced at a track that's now, you know, it's now retired from NASCAR competition, but the Rockingham Speedway, a very historic track here in North Carolina. And I was driving there, but the funny part was I had driven all kinds of race cars, and I realized when we got to the track that weekend, when I was getting there, and they said, okay, go take a couple laps around to get a feel for it, just to drive around in a rental car. It's like, oh, crap. I've never driven a real street car around anywhere. So I remember going on the back straightaway, and Rockingham is famous for being a very abrasive track with its seashell made-up asphalt surface. So I remember going through the corner, and we had this really old Hyundai rental car, and I remember sitting back there, and my dad starting to get nervous, and I pulled off, and he's like, and I said, why were you so nervous? And he goes, did you know how fast you're going? I was like, I don't know, what, 35, 45? He goes, no, on the back straight, we were going about 105 in the rental car. I was like, oh, shoot.
Yeah.
So I guess needless to say, I'd always had, you know, some knack for speed. A lot of people, you know, when it came to fear and the anxiety side of what, you know, people would think driving a race car would be like, they always ask, you know, what's it like to wreck? What's it like to drive that fast? And for me, you know, growing up through that area and eventually, you know, going from being 13 years old and doing that, and then eventually basically climbing the ladder of the steps all the way up to NASCAR's top series and NASCAR Cup Series and racing the Daytona 500, people would always ask me and say, you know, what's that like? Is that scary? Is it stressful? And to me, that was the calmest, quietest place on earth, was behind the race car in 145 degrees in that cockpit, because the heat inside those cars is insane. Going 200 miles an hour, a football field a second, with 39 other cars around you, hitting you, whatever it may be, that was the quietest, happiest, most peaceful place in the world, which sounds absolutely ridiculous.
Now, Matt, this sounds like the perfect story so far, right? From a young age, the father-son outings, and then being able to convince them, and then, you know, even the hilarious story of driving the rental car at 100-plus miles an hour around a track. Like, this sounds great. And then being able to race in the Daytona 500. Like, this is the fairy tale. You know, now you're on top of the podium. You're getting the trophy, and we're showering you with champagne. But that isn't how this story continues.
Well, it's not even how it went, to be honest with you. And we'll get to real quick where we're at now. But even in the middle of that, so 2019 is when I raced in the Daytona 500, drove for Front Row Motorsports and NASCAR Cup Series. Again, the major leagues, if NASCAR's were Jeff Gordon, Dale Jr., all them raced in. But in 2016, I was actually sidelined. I was diagnosed after a wreck that I had for some pain in my back, and I had reoccurring issues of problems in my head with light sensitivity and some bad headaches and paranoia, things like that. And so after this wreck, I went in and I was getting an MRI for my back, and I said, hey, doc, you know, I've got this stuff going on. So they found a mass in my right frontal lobe, And more than likely, that wreck probably saved my life because it was a benign brain tumor, but it was the type to become malicious, malignant eventually. So that was a blessing in disguise. And I was told by doctors that I would never race again. And in 3 months, I was back on the NASCAR circuit.
Wow.
But of course, like you said, it's no fairy tale ending when it comes to the driving side. So, the 2019 season was going great in my rookie year in the major leagues, and so we made it all the way down to Martinsville, which is a small track up in Virginia. So we were there. October 26th was the date, so about Halloween weekend. And so I was, I had been horribly sick for the last 2 weeks before then, horrendous food poisoning, unfortunately. And so I was feeling like crap. I drove to the track that morning and, drove, parked my truck, talked to one of my buddies walking into the racetrack. About 3 minutes later was, putting a cup of coffee on in the race car hauler in the inside of the track in the semi truck. And, before I knew it, I felt my tongue all of a sudden just go straight backwards in my mouth and my eyes roll back. And all I could think was, I'm dying. And so I just said a prayer real quick and just, said, God, please let me wake up again. And, I fell to the floor. I woke up, 2-3 hours later in the ambulance leaving the racetrack and going to a local hospital. And, it turned out that I had my first seizure, and that was my my start of my epilepsy journey. And so that kind of came out of nowhere. And so unfortunately, my next one would happen just a couple months later. I got married, so my wife and I, we had a beautiful wedding and reception there, and so we went off to Aruba. And then 3 days into the trip there, I was with her and had my second seizure, and in that one I actually stopped breathing. I turned completely blue, apparently.
Oh, geez.
And I didn't wake up for about 4 hours after. So that one, those two were very, very violent. So obviously something happened there. And so it takes two to really go, okay, well, you got epilepsy. And I was taking medication at that point, that's the first one. But, that's kind of when my whole world – switch upside down. And I knew after the first one, nobody knew, like, okay, maybe it's a fluke, maybe something happened. So I hadn't given up on racing, hadn't given up on stuff. But when that second one happened, I learned what anxiety was. I learned what epilepsy was. And I also knew at that point that my career was over.
Yeah. But not necessarily over, and that's what I want to make sure that we have enough time to be able to discuss, is that maybe that driving part of your career was over, but taking the experience that you had, both scary and hopeful, and then saying, you know what, it's not over, this is a passion that I have, let's see what I can do now, having this awareness of epilepsy and this connection with NASCAR. So what are you doing currently?
Absolutely. So yeah, I'll give you the quick run through. So right now I've become NASCAR's youngest current team owner, with my friend and partner BJ McLeod, as both of us the youngest NASCAR team owners. So during quarantine, we had this crazy idea of, hey, let's go start a NASCAR team. Now, in NASCAR, you can say, hey, let's start a team. That's great. You can bring a car to the track. But you need what's called a charter, which is basically like a franchise. That guarantees you in the show, just like NFL or MLB, whatever. So we just happened to be, we hit the timing about 2 days perfectly, because after that we had bidding wars with, we secured our charter or our franchise there before Michael Jordan, Justin Marsh, who is another extremely great businessman, Floyd Mayweather, all these guys, Dale Jr., all these guys are trying to get a franchise. So we got this in before Michael Jordan is going to go buy one. Obviously, all these big celebrities now are trying to get into NASCAR. So, we were able to somehow get in there, and now we formed, Live Fast Motorsports. We're in the middle of our first year, and it's been incredible. Being a driver was kind of the tip of the iceberg when you look at, the knowledge and stuff that you have within the sport, and looking at the picture of like an iceberg, you look at the giant 80% of the bottom of that iceberg. That's being an owner. That's knowing everything that goes behind the scenes,
in the sponsorship world, and you know, which I did a little bit when I was a driver, but this year we've been able to sell over 80% of our events, even though we you know, had the COVID year starting really our whole program in December. So that's been great. That's kind of my head of the program. And then my buddy BJ, he drives the car, and then he also does the competition side. So that's been incredible. And then, you know, like from the sponsor side, we've had so many people help us with my sales team. But then also, you know, that's what makes this deal goes around. That's NASCAR moving billboards. But
yeah,
then we get to do some kind of special things. And that's where I want to make sure I hit on real quick is that like this weekend, we have a car. It was crowdfunded for donations to charity back to the American Brain Tumor Association and Celsius Energy Drink, which we've worked with them all year long. And I've worked with them a few years in the past, but they donated thousands upon thousands of dollars to the American Brain Tumor Association and our race team to help us not only put the car on the track, but help them go find more treatments and research for folks like myself who were affected by brain tumors. I lost my grandmother to a brain tumor, and we ran this campaign where people could put their names and donate to put their name or a loved one's name on our race car.
Cool.
So we have a few hundred. Yeah, so we have a few hundred people on our car this weekend with them or their loved one's name riding with us this weekend. So it's really, really exciting.
You know, worth noting a couple things. One, I don't know that you would have ever thought in your life that you would have beaten Michael Jordan at something. That's pretty cool that you're able to get that charter. And
sure.
And you can tell people, you know, I beat one of the greatest of all time. And then second of all, that, you know, that things are as such that it could have very easily been a situation where you turned pretty sour and just said, oh, forget it, and turned your back on racing and turned your back on, you know, those folks within the American Brain Tumor Association. And what you've instead decided to do is, you know what, this is the situation that I'm in. I've got this buddy. He can do this part. I can do this part. And that, you know, you have not only pivoted, but really thrived in what you're doing by being one of the youngest team owners, you and your partner, and by continuing to do this and provide hope for those that find themselves in a similar situation.
Yeah, you know, I think there's two things in life that you can do. It's either be positive and find the good thing or and move on and try to find, you know, how to keep on working on things. Or you can sit there and you can feel sorry for yourself. And don't get me wrong, I did that for a bit. But then all of a sudden, you know, I resented NASCAR. I resented the things that happened to me. Then all of a sudden quarantine hit, and it gave me a good reset point of like, okay, what do I really want to do? And I was like, I still want to be in racing. And that's where this whole thing came about. But, you know, whether it's the brain tumor, coming back from that to go racing, or coming back from epilepsy, never being able to drive really again racing-wise, but still being involved, you know, in life there's so many curveballs thrown at you. And I think you either grab it and say, I'm going to take control of this thing, and you find a way, or you sit there and you just let it take you. And don't get me wrong, it's taken lots of therapy, lots of thought, lots of meditation, and even a few hypnosis sessions. But it is a process. It's a grind. And whether it's a race team or a job or whether it's a dog you lose, like life is always about those two choices. Which one?
Matt, thank you for being on the show with us today. Matt, a race car driver, team owner of car number 78 at this year's Daytona 500. He and his partner are the youngest team owners this season. Thank you so much for being on the show. Coming up, we're going to discuss how to stop yelling and start connecting. You're listening to The Lisa Show.
You found it. Now don't forget where you put it. Welcome to The Lisa Show.
Does the idea of small talk starting up again make you break out in a cold sweat? Well, coming up in 20 minutes, we're going to dive into the sweet art of small talk. And coming up in your morning buzz, put on your calendar the 29th of July, 2022. Go ahead, get your phone out, get that paper calendar that you got from the automotive shop, you know, whatever. Mark on that date, July 29th, 2022. I'll tell you in 15 minutes what's coming up on that date. Maybe it's once a day, more likely it's like 5 times a day or 10 times a day, or maybe you don't even want to count. No matter what your kids are doing, they are going to fight. And whenever they fight, you as the parent are forced to intervene, which usually means yelling and a lot of tears. So by the end of it all, no one is happy and everyone is upset. And as unhappy as this scenario sounds, the good news is that it does not have to be this way. We can avoid red faces, we can avoid the yelling, and instead use these moments of tension to coach and to connect with our kids. So what is the magic solution to this almost sounding fake scenario? Well, we have to invite Dr. Laura Markham, clinical psychologist and author of Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids, to give us that magic solution. Welcome, Dr. Markham.
Thanks for having me.
So we all know about these situations, these tense, loud situations that we get ourselves into. How, and we'll, I'm sure, drill down on this, can we avoid these situations?
Well, you're talking about two things. One is, how do you avoid them? Prevention.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a big topic. And the other is, what do you do when they happen? So the number one thing to avoid it is strengthen your relationship with each child and teach your so that they don't have to have sibling rivalry.
Mm-hmm.
And then teach them how to navigate differences. Because every relationship, every human relationship is going to have differences of opinion. And when two kids have immature brains, which they do, they don't necessarily negotiate very well. So you also want to teach your kids how to work through a conflict in a more constructive way. And they'll use that skill for the rest of their lives.
And I'm hearing you say that, and you kind of couched it in the idea of children will have these sort of contrarian or different ideas and have to be able to navigate that. And I'm thinking, I know a lot of adults who could probably benefit from this ability to be able to have conversations or have differences and not just become infuriated at one another.
Wouldn't it be amazing to live in a world where people could actually acknowledge the other person's perspective, acknowledge that there's truth on both sides, or at least needs on both sides, and be respectful as we navigate, you know, what we each want out of the situation. That would be, well, we just start with our marriages. What would that look like?
Yeah. So maybe we take our time and we divide it like we sort of queued up into two different parts. One, in this first part, let's talk a little bit about prevention, how we can avoid these things from happening and dive a little bit deeper. And then in the second half of our discussion, let's really talk about how, when they do happen, we haven't been able to prevent them, how we can make our way through them at that point. So prevention, let's dive just a little bit deeper into it.
Okay. So I did mention that your relationship with each child matters.
Mm-hmm.
If you are making comments like, why can't you be like your brother?
Mm.
Or your sister doesn't do that, right? Then you're building sibling rivalry. So if instead you just talk to that child about what you need to say to them, leaving the sibling out of it totally, and you never compare your kids, there will be less fighting.
Mm.
The other thing you need is basic household rules, like you can say what you need or want without attacking your sibling, right? We listen to what the other person says. We're kind, where we treat each other with respect, right? So you can actually set up family norms to resolve conflicts more peacefully. You can teach kids to calm themselves down, too, so that they don't attack.
Do you feel like these norms that you're setting up, like, is this something that we're painting on the wall or putting in vinyl lettering and saying, look at, these are our norms, or are these just sort of things that are discussed with our families?
I think if you have too many things up on your wall, nobody will take them in anymore. So you have to keep it pretty simple.
Uh-huh.
But you could say, what are our rules in our family?
Mm.
Number one, mom and dad are in charge.
Yeah.
Right? That's a number one rule. Number two, we treat everybody with respect. Mom and dad do that, and kids do that with each other. Respect and kindness, I would say. So be kind could be a really important rule. And those, to me, are the most important rules. And you could add another one if you want, like everybody cleans up their own messes. That's a pretty great one. But I wouldn't do 10 of them. And, in fact, the research shows it's better to have just a few so that kids actually commit them to memory. But, you know, be kind and respectful obviously encompasses a lot of things. So then when your kid is yelling at your other kid, you can say, whoa, our family rule is be kind and respectful. That means you can tell your brother what you want without yelling at him. Let's take a deep breath. Let's calm down. Let's try that again. I'm here to help.
Do these sort of tactics work on really young kids?
So with, I would say with all people, when they're upset, the most important thing to do is to empathize with them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's especially true of young kids, right? So the reason is, I mean, just imagine you're really upset at somebody, you know, a colleague, your partner, and you're ranting and raving about it. And somebody says, no, don't act like that. Be kind and respectful. You're going to say, no, this is an exception to the rule because this person did something egregious, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, children feel the same way.
Mm.
So we need to start by saying, wow, I see why you're so upset. And you can tell this person what you need without being disrespectful. And with little kids, you have to use different words, but it's even more important because they're really swept away in the emotion. So you say, you are so mad. You are mad at your brother. No hitting. Hitting hurts. Or you can take a breath. You can tell your brother, I'll help you. Let's go tell your brother how you feel that he did X, Y, Z.
Mm-hmm.
So you start by empathizing. And then you reassure your very young child, you're there to help solve the problem. You're going to help them get their need met, help them express themselves. And you still set a definite limit on the way they're allowed to treat each other.
I think the empathy is a thing that is a lot easier to find my way into if, you know, it's if it's calm or if it's the first time that something has occurred. But by the time it's the 10th fight of the day and I just want it to stop and I need other things to be, you know, going on, or I just need them to be quiet, or any number of scenarios, like it seems like my patience for empathy disappears.
Yes, that is absolutely true. Yes, for all of us, all of us.
Yeah.
And so I would say that whatever your capacity is at a given moment is a function of, you know, what you've already had to do that day.
Yeah.
And yet we can all improve on our ratio of good to bad moments.
Mm.
Because it's usually, you know, parents will say to me, it was just the 10th time and I just couldn't deal with it anymore and I smacked him.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, I totally get that. And if your child said to you, it was the 10th time my sibling did this and I couldn't take it anymore and I smacked them, you would say to your child, not allowed. Sorry.
Yeah.
Use your words. So I think even though, of course, parents get fed up, and by the 10th time we've just had it, especially if one child is being mean to the other. And
right.
we, you know, that raises our hackles and we go into Papa Bear or Mama Lion mode, you know, and we want to protect our child. But I would say we always, you know, we get in between the kids if they're hitting each other
sure.
or even screaming at each other. We get in between them, and then our job is to be the grown-up and to calm the situation. So if we know it's the end of a long time, again, prevention is really helpful. Separate them before you get to this point, right? Or meet your own needs. Notice you're running on empty, and that the next time it happens, you're not going to have anything left, and you are going to start smacking or screaming. So instead, separate the kids, put them each into, you know, a different place, doing something quiet, or maybe you'll read a book to both of them if you can't keep them apart. Make yourself a cup of tea. Take a minute to replenish you if you can do that. And I think we run on empty as parents so mm-hmm. often. And then when we dig deep, there's nothing there.
Yeah.
So we need to take care of us before we get to that point.
We're talking with Dr. Laura Markham about how to stop yelling, how to really start connecting with our kids. We've been talking and focusing on prevention. Now, maybe in the remainder of the time that we have, like we didn't prevent it, or we did our very best, but it's still occurring. A lot of the things that we talked about within the prevention piece exist in this piece as well. But are there any differences as we find ourselves in the thick of our children just yelling and screaming, and we feel like we've done the things, we've shown the empathy, we've tried to separate, but we still have to bring them back together for school or for dinner time or whatever the thing may be.
Mm-hmm.
What do we do in those instances?
Well, if there's actually an altercation going on, first of all, you do get in between them and stop it. And as you're doing this, you're trying to take a deep breath, because our job is to settle the storm, not escalate it.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they're fighting is that they feel like their needs won't get met. They feel actually afraid. I know that sounds crazy, a kid hitting the other kid, but he's afraid because his brother just, you know, almost broke something that he's playing with, or almost knocked something down, or almost took something he wanted and needed. And so there's a lot of fear and loathing going on between the kids. And it's our job to settle that. So we take a deep breath. We try to stay calm. We come into the middle of it and we say, whoa, 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 to get their attention. And then we take a deep breath and we lower our voice. Whoa, you two are so mad. You're empathizing. Mm-hmm. They feel like you're seeing them. And once they feel seen, they're more able to be open to your influence. Okay, maybe somebody will help me. Whoa, 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 you two are so upset. We can fix this. I'm right here. And then you may well set a limit. Like one of them may say, no, it's her fault. I'm not going to, you know, and start screaming again. And you say, the rule in our house is we treat each other with kindness and respect. Hmm. Take a breath. I want to hear what you have to say. Let's try a do-over. No screaming, no hurtful language. Let's take a deep breath. Let's all sit down. Come on. And you actually, if you can, you touch each child. Hmm. So, Brian, you sit down right here on my right. You know, Susanna, you sit here on my left. Let's take some deep breaths so we can calm down and tell each other what's going on so we can hear. Now, if you said so we can listen to each other, that's good, except they don't want to listen to each other. They just want to tell each other. So this helps them feel hopeful, you know. And one very important rule at this point, treat them the same. Mm-hmm. You may think that Susanna, the bigger one, always Brian is a bully to Brian. You may
sure.
think that.
Sure.
But if you come in and say, Susanna, you stop that right now. You're the oldest. You should know better. Why are you always, you know, bothering your brother, hurting your brother, whatever? Or Brian, you're the youngest one. You're always in your sister's things. I told you not to do that, you know, whatever. If you do that, that child, what's their takeaway? Mom or dad loves the other one more than me. Mm. They always win. I hate them. Wait till I get them alone, you know. Mm-hmm. No one ever understands me, right? So it increases the sibling rivalry. So our job is to treat them the same and to help each child feel heard, get each child, give them a chance to talk to the other one. So you can say, let's see. What I saw is two kids who were so upset and screaming. It sounded like you wanted to play the game this way, Susanna, and Brian wanted to play it the other way. Is that right? Is that what happened?
Mm-hmm.
You want each child to be able to then weigh in a little bit about what happened. And also to hear each other. So you say, wow, Susanna, it sounds like you have something really important to tell your brother. What do you want to tell him? And she says, don't do that, whatever it is, you know.
Yeah.
And you say, so you really want your brother not to X, Y, Z, and to do, and then you might try to reframe it positively. You want your brother to wait his turn. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And she says, you know, yes. And you say to Brian, wow, so your sister told you something that's really important to her, and it sounds like you have something you want to tell her, too. Mm. Now, most parents at this point will say to me, I don't have time for this.
I just need
dinner on the table.
I just need him to be quiet. I just need him to do the thing. I don't have time to work through the. Yeah, I can see that.
Of course. And here's the thing. It usually takes a couple months of doing this, and you don't have to do it 10 times a day. If they're fighting 10 times a day, do it for 3 times. Do it for the number of times you can actually do it calmly. The other times, just separate your kids. Just separate them and say, you guys can't play together without fighting right now. It seems like you need some space. And just separate them. But the more you do this during this time period, the more quickly they will learn. And you will hear, depending on the age of your children, even 4- and 5-year-olds, you'll hear them within a few weeks saying things to each other like, our family rule is be kind. It's not kind when you say that. Or, I need you to wait your turn. Can you wait your turn, please? Hmm. Or, I was still using that. Can you give it back, please? They actually begin to, and research backs this up. We watch kids on video do this, and the parents can't believe that their children, they're now hearing their children use their family rules and actually relate in a more productive way. But it's because we're modeling it and teaching it.
Wow. For people who have never heard of this principle before, this way to interact with our kids, I'm sure that their minds are just being opened to this possibility of a peaceful home. Is this the kind of thing that people can instructively learn from Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids?
Oh, absolutely. I have three books, though, and my second book is Peaceful Parent, Happy Siblings. And that goes through in detail how to do this when you have kids and you're navigating between them. Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids, the first one, is about how to develop emotional intelligence and how to help your child want to cooperate with you when you have one child or with each child in a larger family. But if you have more children and they're fighting with each other, then you might want the sibling book because it really walks you through this. And it still teaches emotional intelligence, right? Each child is learning. Think about it. When they're sitting there breathing, not screaming at each other, trying hard, they're developing impulse control. They're developing empathy.
Yeah.
They're listening to each other, and they're developing more better judgment.
It's remarkable. Is then the third book, the Peaceful Parent, Happy Kids workbook, is this just a way we can work with our kids? Is it more parent-faced to be able to help our kids?
It's more parent-faced because what I heard from parents who'd read the first two books is, I love your books, but I still have a hard time setting limits well. I either get too angry and fly off the handle, or I'm too permissive. And so this gives you practice setting limits, empathizing as you do it, so kids want to cooperate, but setting limits in a fair and clear way so kids actually want to follow your direction. It also helps you connect more with your child, and it also helps with emotion coaching. So when you have a kid with big emotions, it helps you relate to those big emotions of your child in a way that helps the child learn more self-regulation.
Dr. Laura Markham, a clinical psychologist and author. Those books you can find online at ahaparenting.com. Thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
When you go to ahaparenting.com, why not check out byuradio.org, an opportunity for you to win a family year annual pass to the national parks. 63 national parks that you'd be able to visit with that. You can go to any of them, all of them, one of them, 10 of them, you get the point. We are doing Lisa's Adventure Club giveaways every week for those annual national parks pass, and we're giving another one away tomorrow. Coming up later in the show, we're going to talk about Grand Teton National Park. That's a place you could go if you won the annual national parks pass, but you can't win if you don't enter. Go to byuradio.org. And the secret word of the week is snacks. Make sure you enter that. That gets you more chances to win. BYURadio.org. Look for the banner that says Lisa's Adventure Club. Enter to win right now, or you will never, ever win that pass. Coming up, we're going to be joined by an expert who will reteach us small talk. And July 29th, 2022, I know exactly where I will be. And I bet you'll be there with me. I'll tell you what's coming up on that date as part of your morning buzz. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Have you ever visited Grand Teton National Park? Well, coming up, we're going to share tips for how to plan the best vacation ever to the Grand Tetons. But first, we've got your morning buzz. It's three things that are trending online, things that folks are talking about. Today is National Bomb Pop Day. One of my favorite delicious treats. I would chase the ice cream man down the street, around the corner, back up the next street in order to get my hands on a Bomb Pop. Do you know what a Bomb Pop is? It's the red, white, and blue thinned popsicle. Came about more than 50 years ago as a way to celebrate America. The official Bomb Pop went away in 1991, that company that started the Bomb Pop, but we can still get them today. Find them at your local grocers. Hashtag not sponsored, but it is National Bomb Pop Today. It means it's summer. Blink-182's famous bassist and vocalist Mark Hoppus announced yesterday on Twitter that he has cancer and that he's been undergoing chemotherapy for the past 3 months. He says, "It sucks and I'm scared. And at the same time, I'm blessed with incredible doctors and family and friends to get me through this." He says, "I can't wait to be cancer free and see you all at a concert in the near future." And then finally this, Harrison Ford, regarding Henry's Harrison Ford.
you know, Indiana Jones, Harrison Ford? Well, apparently, he was rehearsing a fight scene for Indiana Jones number 5, and he hurt himself. The extent of his injury, not immediately known. It involves something with his shoulder. They're going to shoot around him while the appropriate course of treatment is evaluated. But on the 29th of July, 2022, Indiana Jones, number 5. My guess is there's another title that's going to come forth. I don't think it's Indiana Jones 5. Although, if we could pattern it after the Fast and Furious episode 9, let's just call it I-5. Anyway, that's just where my mind goes. The 5th Indiana Jones installment coming out on the 29th of July, 2022. I'll buy you popcorn. Let's get there to that movie. That, my friends, is your morning buzz. Over the past year, many of our social muscles have severely atrophied. We've spent more time enjoying the conversations and interactions of actors on a screen than actually talking and interacting with the people around us. So now, the world, of course, opening up again, we may find it slightly more uncomfortable than usual to strike up small talk. Wait, for an instance, at your office's water cooler, if this is the first time you've been back in the office in a year. In fact, some of us really may wonder why we even use small talk to begin with, right? It seems trivial. We haven't done it for a long time, and now we have a different perspective on it. So does polite chit-chat have a purpose in our society? How do we start small-talking again after a year of social isolation? Well, here to help us answer these questions is one of the world's leading experts on business networking, Mr. Ivan Meisner. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you so much. I appreciate you having me on.
You know, I really just wanted to start this conversation with a little bit of small talk. So how are things going today?
Things are going great. Absolutely great. You know, after the year-long, a lot of people called it lockdown or quarantine. I prefer to call it the great pause because I think words matter. And the pause button was hit on all of our lives. So once really outgoing people are now, I've talked to some of them, they're coming down with loco brevis phobia, which is a really big word meaning the fear of small talk. And small talk, you just did a perfect example of how to open up a conversation. And small talk is important because it's a way of making connections with people, and those connections then lead to professional relationships, and those relationships are what networking is all about.
What I've really actually loved about kind of coming out of the pandemic, where there wasn't as much social interaction and now having the ability to make social interaction, I can remember vividly, Ivan, as we talk, I can remember my vivid first time in a public forum where like socialization was going to occur. And it was funny because I am not a guy who gets nervous, right? And I found myself getting a little anxious about being in this forum. And quickly I was like, oh, no, I got this. But I found on the topic of sort of this small talk and this chit chat that I didn't do very much of this. I kind of was like, hey, how are you? And also, how has the last year been? Are you making it? Like what, like more sort of peeling that layer quicker and getting to a more meatier connection?
Yeah. Well, look, you know, I think it's important that I not bury the lead. It's really interesting in small talk to be more interested than interesting.
Hmm.
And so by asking questions, and that's easy. You know, introverts have a hard time networking, they feel. But the truth is a great networker has two ears and one mouth and uses them both proportionately.
Yeah.
So opening up with a question. So I would, you know, asking about how things were for you in the last year is a good question, but be prepared because it could be an emotionally loaded question. They may have had a loved one who got really sick or, heaven forbid, passed away. And so, you know, be careful with that one, but it is a good one. You could talk about family. How's everyone doing? Here's a really important one. Spend some time reacquainting yourself with pop culture and current events. Hmm. Weird news, a celebrity-related story. It's a great way to open up a conversation. A TV show, a new TV show that you've really gotten into. These are the kinds of things that kind of begin a conversation that leads to a relationship.
It's an interesting counterpoint, though, because, like, because we all collectively, though not in the same place and in the same situation, have been through for all intents and purposes, a pretty traumatic experience. It seems almost inauthentic to not address it in conversation and to really get to the heart of it with some people. Maybe I'm skewed about this, but like to go to a thing like, did you see that YouTube video, when I know the person is maybe their first or second time out of their house, or like you mentioned, had the loss of a loved one. Like it almost on some level seems a little insulting to just be like, yeah, what about that Twitter feed? Did you see that?
Yeah, well, look, you know, there's nothing wrong with going there. Just go there gently,
yeah.
I said.
Yeah.
Because, you know, if you say, oh, man, how was the pandemic for you? Well, my child died.
Yeah.
You know, that you want to go there. How are you doing is a great way of opening that conversation. How are you doing? How did you do all right throughout the pandemic in a very gentle way? Because you just don't know what, you know, how it was for them. And then as you get to understand how it was for them, then going that direction is great. It's fine. I mean, for example, talking about, you know, was there anything that came out of the great pause that you found positive? And I love when I'm asked that question, because I say, yeah, I didn't have to travel. I have 2 million miles on one airline.
Jeez.
So it was the longest I've gone in my adult life without getting on a plane. And that was fantastic for me. And so talking about what positive things may have happened is a great way to open up that conversation.
If you're just joining this conversation, I'm talking with Ivan Meisner about small talk, all aspects of it, especially in this unique time where we're coming out of the great pause. I like the way that you frame that. So much anxiety I feel around small talk is that we almost work ourselves up into a lather, right? I hate small talk. Oh, small talk. And really, once we get it, we're fine. But we create it in our mind to be this, you know, this great wall that we're going to have to find our way over somehow. Why do you think that is?
Well, if we don't know someone really well, we don't know where to go. We don't know what to talk about. But the key is to do a little bit of small talk to find overlapping areas of interest. I'm going to give me an example. I did an exercise years ago I run an organization called BNI, and I had a chapter do an exercise about connecting with each other through basically small talk. And I had two guys who did not want to do it. They're like, this is silly. I don't want to do it. I'm like, well, just follow this process. They found out in the process that they were both soccer coaches for their sons' soccer teams. Forget about the rest of the process. They were so focused on coaching and soccer that they made an incredible connection. Huh. And here's two guys that had never referred business to each other, being as a referral organization. They'd never referred business to each other. Then within a few weeks, they started passing referrals to each other because they made the connection. So the goal of small talk is to find possible connections, areas of interest to have discussions with people.
It's such a skill, I think. I mean, it can be perfected, and we all know those people who we talk to them. We haven't met them, but they engage us, or maybe even we engage them, and we're done in a minute, and we feel like we're their best friend, or we refer all of our business to them, or whatever that thing may be. What do you think it is that separates those that, you know, are good, can navigate some small talk, to really great?
So I think extroverts are pretty good at that. However, their favorite subject tends to be, what would you guess?
Themselves.
Yes. So they may come across as being good at small talk, but their focus is themselves. And I think that an extrovert has to really learn how to be quiet and listen. Introverts, they don't necessarily like talking, but if they can develop the skill of asking questions, then, and that's the two ears and one mouth idea, is if they can develop the skill of just asking questions and then following that line of discussion, then they can be great at networking. So both introverts and extroverts can be great at networking, but it takes a different skill set for them. The extrovert has to learn to shut up, and the introvert has to learn how to ask a few questions.
Do you think that there is a loss on some level of, since we're not gathering in work buildings, or haven't been, and in some cases, you know, we're hearing about, you know, large companies, corporations not having people return. Is there something inherently lost from those, you know, water cooler chats or the lunchroom sit downs?
Yeah, so it's a much more complex issue, I think, than people may realize. The short answer to that is yes, I think there is something lost. The longer answer involves it's inevitable. Hmm. The technology is going in a direction where, you know, having the ability to connect with people online is getting better and better. I wrote an article for entrepreneur.com 3 years ago that said the future of face-to-face is online. And I'm the founder of the world's largest in-person networking organization. My members thought, oh, man, the old man's losing it. What's he thinking? But look, I said it because of technology. You know, Microsoft right now is working on holographic technologies on a screen, but it's three-dimensional. Huh. I saw it. It's amazing. It's inevitable. And so here's what I would say to business people out there going, I don't want it. Mm-hmm. Well, you can either be afraid of change or you can embrace change. And if you don't embrace the change, you're going to get disrupted. It's just inevitable. And I want to lead the disruption, not be disrupted. So, yeah, the technology is on its way. But younger people have a whole lot less problem than guys like me with gray hair. You know, they don't mind it. And so I think it's inevitable.
You know, also kind of coming back into play are things like conferences, like these opportunities to network professionally. For those that maybe don't have that struggle, you know, when they're within their own company or, you know, in their comfort zone, but go to something like that, an opportunity that they have literally paid for to make these great connections, but find that to be more difficult. What sort of advice do you have in that sort of realm?
To do it in person or online?
Yeah, to do it in person or online, I guess, since some of those things are moving online as well.
They're blended. And that's where I think the future is in the short term, is blended experiences. A year ago, you know, we have 10,000 networking groups around the world. A year ago, if we would have asked them, would you like to go online, I would bet 2% of those chapters would have said yes. But we just did a survey of our members. 51% said they would like a blended version. 16% said just online, which leaves about 20% saying only in person. So the world has changed when it comes to networking. I think what's likely is a blended version to begin with. For example, our groups meet every week, so it might be 3 weeks out of the month. It's online, 1 week in person. Nothing beats being in person, looking someone in the three-dimensional eyes and shaking their hands. Mm. It's more powerful. You make a better connection. And so I think that what we're going to see is a blended version of this happening with conferences and with networking events.
Now, you are the founder of BNI. You are, you know, the head of the world's largest networking organization. I'm hoping that your answer gives permission to some of us. Do you ever just not feel like networking, like not talking?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely, I do. But, you know, the truth is, I have to remind myself it's about building relationships.
Yeah.
I'll tell you an example. Here's an example of one where I was like, oh, God, why am I sitting here? I went to an event, an organization that I belong to, and there's a lot of amazing business people. And across from me was a college student. And I thought, here's a chance to have dinner with these two people who were, you know, New York Times best-selling authors, authors like me. I could have had a great – and I'm sitting across from a college student.
Uh-huh.
And I so didn't want to have this conversation. But then I was like, I not literally, but I emotionally smacked myself up the side of the head and said, hey, wait a minute. You're supposed to be a networking expert. Immerse yourself. And you know what? I just started asking her questions. It was one of the most interesting evenings that I had, listening to her talk about her college experience. And we must have spoke for 2 hours. But here's the amazing thing. As we were walking out the door, her father was there. He was the member. And he leaned over to me and he said, Ivan, thank you. Nobody has a deep conversation with her because she's my daughter. And they, you know, they want to talk to me, the author. They don't want to talk to her. Thank you. Yeah, you know, she will remember this for years because you really engaged with her. So unknowingly, I made a great connection with somebody because I treated her daughter with interest. Be interested, not just interesting.
Ivan Meisner, the founder of BNI. You can go to BNI.com. It's the world's largest networking organization. If you want to learn more, get tips, tricks for small talk or enhancing your networking skills, you can also go to IvanMeisner.com. Ivan, thanks for being on the show.
Hey, thank you so much. And at Ivan Meisner, there's tons of free blogs and content. I've been blogging there since 2007.
So check that out. That's IvanMeisner.com. We'll leave a link in the show notes. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Another great edition of Lisa's Adventure Club coming up. This time, we're traveling to Grand Teton National Park. Hang tight. You're listening to The Lisa Show. Pack your bags. Do you have your snacks? Wait a minute. Snacks? Wait a minute. That's the key word of the week for Lisa's Adventure Club. Go to BYURadio.org right now and enter that keyword. You could win an annual National Parks Pass. The keyword is snacks. If you do not enter to win, I can 100% promise you that you will not win. Have to enter to win. We'll be giving away that annual National Parks Pass tomorrow. And you could, in fact, with that annual National Parks Pass, travel to Grand Teton National Park. Today, we've invited James Neely, who is a retired radiologist, but whose passion in life is photography, to come and tell us a little bit about the beautiful landscapes and the passion that he has for Grand Teton National Park. Welcome, James.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on, Richie.
Now, people have probably heard the name Grand Teton, but give us an idea of where in the world this is.
Well, it's in western Wyoming, and it's a relatively small park that's only 10 miles south of Yellowstone National Park. So most people know where Yellowstone is. And it includes this magnificent mountain range, the Grand Tetons, and named after the highest peak, the Grand Teton, which is 13,770 feet tall, and includes the land to the east of this Teton Range. So it's a beautiful, relatively small park, but a wonderful area to explore.
I think when we say things like Yellowstone, there is a vision that comes to mind of what that park looks like. What are some of the characteristics of the Grand Tetons that would make it unique?
Well, I think a lot of the characteristics are the same. The wildlife, there's abundant wildlife in both parks. There are rivers, lakes in both parks, but Yellowstone kind of emphasizes a lot of the geological features, whereas the Grand Tetons, I think, probably the showcase is the wonderful mountains, which are considered the youngest in the Rocky Mountain Range. So they're quite abrupt and new-looking mountains, and they rise quite prominently from the Snake River Plain. So I think that's one of the reasons that people love to go to the Tetons.
Now, when you talk about and say, you know, it's very similar to Yellowstone, but I don't feel like we get as much attention on the Grand Tetons as we do on Yellowstone. And it's no sort of competition. But do you think that the Grand Tetons is then maybe a little bit better kept secret?
Well, that probably is true. That's probably true. A lot of people don't realize that they're so close. And that you can really explore both of them on a single vacation, and I think you're right. It probably is a good secret that people don't know about.
So now you have an interesting perspective on this park because you are a photographer. I would be curious how you have engaged Grand Teton National Park with your passion for photography.
Thanks for asking. I've lived in Idaho Falls, which is about a 2-hour drive from Jackson Hole for 36 years. And I really didn't explore Grand Teton National Park for a long time, probably 22 years of my living here in Idaho Falls. I did visit there occasionally, but then about 14 years ago, I took a photographic workshop that visited Grand Teton and Yellowstone parks. And in preparation for that workshop, I learned about some of the classic photo spots in Grand Teton National Park, and became so interested and amazed at the beauty in this area. And so since for that 14 years since then, I've probably visited the park three or four or five times a year. To just explore, take pictures, and enjoy the beauty there.
Each of our national parks, it seems, has that one or maybe couple, you know, classic shots from within the park, right? When I think of Acadia National Park up in Maine, it's, you know, the beach there with the lighthouse. I forget the name of the beach. I think Pontiac Beach is, I think, what it's called. Or we think of, like, you know, the eruption of Old Faithful in Yellowstone. What is that iconic thing about the Grand Teton National Park that people sort of flock to for photos?
Well, you're right. There are several that are world famous, really, among photographers and people that like to take pictures. One is Oxbow Bend, which is on the northern part of the park. It's a bend in the Snake River that is in front of Mount Moran, which is one of the beautiful peaks in the Tetons. That has beautiful fall colors. People from all over the world come to look at that during the fall, but really any time of the year is a beautiful spot. There is the Snake River Overlook, which is just a stop along the highway. State Highway 89 goes right through the park, and this is one of the stops where Ansel Adams took a classic photo of the Grand Teton with the Snake River winding in front. So that's another wonderful spot. Then there's the there are some interesting barns on they're called the Moulton Barns, and they're on a little road called Mormon Row, where some early settlers built their homesteads, and these produce beautiful foreground pictures with the mountains in the background. There are two barns that a lot of people visit, and they're quite close and easy to access. And I guess that maybe the fourth one I'd mention is a place called Schwabacher's Landing. And this is one of the threads of the Snake River that has been dammed up by some beavers. There are some beaver dams there, and produces some small lakes that the mountains reflect in. And that area was recently upgraded, the road to it, so that you can drive down more easily to the landing and take some wonderful pictures. So that, I guess those are four of the spots that I really enjoy.
I appreciate you giving us this this really in-depth perspective from someone who has visited Grand Teton National Park, you know, more than once, three, four times a year for the last several years. James Neely, the photographer's name that we're speaking with, about Grand Teton National Park. I also appreciated the way you said Schwabacher. That is just fun to say that I wanted the opportunity to be able to throw that in the conversation.
Now try to spell it.
Yeah, no thank you. No thank you. You don't have to spell things on the radio, only say them. I am curious, you probably get asked this a bunch. Someone will relay an experience that they go to the national park and they get either, you know, their digital SLR, you know, the fancy lensed cameras, or they get out their phone and they say, oh man, it was the most beautiful thing. I got the most amazing picture. And then they look at it and they go, oh, this isn't nearly as great as it looked in person. What kind of advice do you have for those of us who want to be able to capture better pictures when we go, you know, maybe specifically to Grand Teton National Park or just national parks in general?
Well, I think there are a lot of things to consider. One of the things generally is to be able to equalize the lights and darks in a picture. When we look at our eyes, the image we see is really synthesized in our brain. Mm-hmm. And our eyes are constantly and subconsciously darting around to different parts of the scene. So we can handle bright areas and dark areas quite easily, whereas a camera takes everything in one shot.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times, I think if you're aware of that, there are several things that you can do. One is take pictures at the time that the lighting is the best, and probably within the Tetons, the sun rises from the east and the mountains are going to be in the sun at sunrise, whereas at sunset, you're going to be shooting into the sun.
Mm.
So picking the time of day is always important. And in the Tetons, on the east side of the Tetons, probably early in the morning or in the daytime, is you're going to get the best photos. But then a little bit of post-processing after, and all of the new cameras will do this, even your iPhone will. You can reduce the brights, and you can raise the level of the darks, and that equalizes the tones in your camera and makes the picture, I think, maybe a little closer to what you actually see with your eyes. And that's always been my goal, to try to portray a feeling, what I have felt when I see a beautiful landscape, rather than just what happens to come out of the camera with one shot.
I really appreciate that. I know I've tried to get you to sort of boil down your passion and years of experience and said, hey, you've got 2 minutes. Tell us how to take better pictures. But I think you did a really great job about being able to do that. As someone who visits Grand Teton National Park a few times a year, I have to know about food places that I should go if I'm visiting. Now, is there a lodge within the park? Are there neighboring cities that I need to try a particular restaurant? Tell me a little bit about the food in and around the park.
Well, I'm probably not the best person to ask, but I think most of the food places, and many visitors base their trip out of Jackson Hole, Wyoming, which mm-hmm. is south of the park. And a lot of them are staying in that location, and that's a great place. On the north part of the park is Jackson Lake Lodge, which has a wonderful restaurant and eating options. And there are some smaller stores, the Jenny Lake Lodge and other places in between, but I think those are the two bookends. And in Jackson, there are many places to eat.
Is there a particular time of year that you feel like is best to go to Grand Teton National Park?
Well, you know, that's one of the unique things about the Tetons or Grand Teton National Park. There is a highway, State Highway 89, that runs right through the park and is opened all year around. And it has several viewpoints that you can access in the middle of the winter if you're prepared, and it gets pretty cold there. I've been to several of these viewpoints at minus 20 degrees.
Jeez.
And fortunately, you can park your car very close to the point that you want to take a picture, but it's just wonderful photography. Main Park Road is open from May to November, and there are it's an awesome time to visit any time during that you can drive, and so I don't know that I would pick or take a particular time. I think spring is wonderful. I think autumn. You know, and you asked about one of the differences between Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Park. I think because of the differences in vegetation that autumn is more spectacular in the Tetons than in Yellowstone, for my opinion. It's just a wonderful time to visit. So,
are you ready for
it? Comes.
I was going to ask you, are you ready for the hardest question of this entire conversation, James?
Oh, sure.
If there is only one place, one stop, one vista, one viewpoint, one hike, I get one thing in Grand Teton National Park, where should I go?
Well, can I tell you a short story?
You've got about a minute.
Okay, well, Macaunt Stewart, a famous artist from Utah, was taken to the Tetons by some of his students and fellow artists, and they were looking at him photograph or painting, and they were all painting the mountains, and they turned around and looked, and he had turned his back on the mountains and was painting the opposite direction. And I guess that would be my advice to anyone going, is to just go and look and enjoy, because there are wonderful scenes wherever you are in the park, and I don't think there's one particular spot that I would.
That's a great response. James Neely, our guest. You can find his website, jamesneely.com, or you can see some of the great photos that he's taken inside Grand Teton National Park by following him on Instagram @James_Neely_photos. The Lisa Show is a production of BYU Radio. You can find everything that you need on the BYU Radio app. You can also listen on demand, and you can find us on SiriusXM Channel 143. If you like something that you heard, you'd like to hear it again, you can download our podcast wherever you get podcasts, places like Spotify, Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Google Play. Look for the subscribe button and make sure you click it. On tomorrow's show, we're giving away another annual National Parks Pass. Be sure you enter right now at BYURadio.org. Thank you for making The Lisa Show a part of your day.